Why do we study hurricanes? Why are we interested in hurricanes?
Because I like that. I like my favorite about hand.
Here?
Yeah.
Okay. So, one of the reasons why we are interested in hurricanes is, well, one of the reasons why I was interested in as a graduate student, because they're fascinating. Structures from fascinating convective modes of the atmosphere, the tropical atmosphere in particular. Okay. Now, the tropics are extremely important for from many perspectives, from general circulation of the atmosphere. They occupy approximately half of the area, okay, the surface of the Earth, and there's a tremendous amount of heat that's being liberated from the ocean, being transported to the polar regions, northern and southern hemisphere. But the tropics turn out to be really a very key player in the regulation of climate. And we have heard recently various debates about the role of hurricanes, typhoons, cyclones in the general circulation of climate. Okay, so let me just, before I get into that, so there's possible climate connection. So vorticity is also something that dominates these structures. Okay, if you don't believe that, then you shouldn't be here. When you see these structures, they're quite vivid, quite spectacular. the vorticity in hurricanes is several orders of magnitude larger than the planetary vorticity of the Earth's rotation. Of course, tornadoes, the vorticity in tornadoes is 4 to 5 orders of magnitude larger than the planetary rotation. But tornadoes are much smaller, and although very severe and very damaging for populated regions in the Midwest and other parts of the world, are not as extensive as the hurricane. Okay, so okay, so this is one reason why we might study hurricanes. Another would be climate connection. Is there one? Okay, there, as I said, there's been some debate about that in the literature based on the recent heightened hurricane activity we've observed in the Northern Hemisphere in 2004 and 2005, in the North Atlantic in particular. Various connections have been hypothesized. One has been that, kind of going back to the old work of Riehl and Malkus, perhaps being revived today, is that the hot towers of the tropics, cumulonimbus towers, the convective circulations of the tropics, hurricanes would be viewed as hot towers, more of a gentle type of hot tower, where the updraft velocities are typically very weak. Maybe the mean updraft velocities in a typical tropical cyclone might be 1 to 2 meters per second, maybe not 50 that you might expect in a supercell. And but they are large, and so you can argue they may transport heat. They may be a very dominant transporter of heat in the vertical. Particular latent and sensible heat. Now, I'm failing at this point because now I'm using acronyms. Latent heat is water heat. So in particular, it's the latent heat of vaporization times the mixing ratio. And sensible heat would be what I would like to call dry heat, or temperature heat. So that would be the specific heat, constant pressure of a gas, times the temperature. Okay. Now, another way that hurricanes could possibly influence the climate, this would be mechanism for heat transport, vertical. Doesn't really make an argument for how is it important to climate in various climate changing scenarios such as global warming, increased CO2, the burden of CO2 that's put in the atmosphere every year. But if they do transport heat, then that would be suggest an important connection. Another one might be radiation. You know, these hurricanes, I don't have a picture.
Yeah,
hurricanes are quite large. Their upper tropospheric circulations is quite expansive. So the size of these circulations, of the upper circulations in a tropical cyclone, could be on the order of 1,000 kilometers across. So perhaps they play a role in the radiation budget. It hasn't been carefully looked at. I'm just raising these as questions, okay? I'm not advocating these necessarily. Okay? Another one that has been advocated and articulated is the role of tropical cyclones in controlling the cell phone. Thermohaline circulation in the ocean. Some would perhaps say that this term thermohaline is no longer appropriate for the ocean. Some would say that the ocean circulation is driven by salt, and salt anomalies, and the density fluctuations incurred by those salt anomalies. But there's some recent work that's now suggesting that perhaps the term thermohaline is a misnomer. In any event, what is the thermohaline circulation? It's an overturning circulation in the ocean, which is analogous to the overturning circulation in the atmosphere. This is the atmosphere. It's the Earth's rotation. The tropical circulation is confined typically between 0 and 30 degrees, current climate, and it's typically dominated by the habicell. Circulation. And in the ocean, there's an analogous overturning circulation that occurs in primary circulation is in the North Atlantic, or the Atlantic sector, also comes up in the Western Pacific, Indonesian region. And Kerry Manuel has advocated that hurricanes, in fact, player in the thermohaline circulation via the turbulent induced heat transport into the abyss, abyssal circulation below the thermocline. Thermocline is the region when you go swimming in the summer in a lake. First few meters are fairly warm, good latitudes, but if you were to dive down underneath, the temperature gets very cold. Ocean, there's an analogous temperature inversion. And so the idea here is that hurricanes, via their mixing that they produce, because they have strong winds, over a very expansive area, strong winds produce very strong shear in the boundary layer of the ocean, in the mixed layer. The shear leads to overturning circulations in the ocean. So you're transporting heat from the upper ocean and the atmosphere across the thermocline into the abyss. And that heat something has to happen to that heat. It's an anomaly that's basically pushed into the abyss and it has to be transported forward. So, just to throw a number out there, Gary has argued that this actually contributes to 15, excuse me. Petawatts heat, and that's a lot of heat.
10-15 watts.
Thank you.
Okay. Petawatts.
We can go up there.
Going a little too fast here. I'm doing this. I'm
pretty good.
Okay. Thanks, Andy. Okay, so you got one times 10 to 15 watts. That's what we call a petawatt. Now, these ideas are actually, all of these ideas that you might think are actually quite interesting and worthy of some good research and good to understand this. Now, you might say this is enough to study hurricanes because perhaps there's a connection to climate. I would say that this is also quite sufficient for me, but some others would argue the climate connection. Fine, we can have it both ways. We can have it both ways. Yes?
So as an outsider, I mean, one of the things I'm learning here in terms of your perspective is that, you know, to a naive outsider, right, we would think, well, as it gets warmer, there's more energy that gets poured into hurricanes. Sort of the causality, as it were, is in that direction. But what you're saying is that the way professionals look at this is there's a heat budget and there's various budgets, and that the question is how hurricanes fit into these, and as conditions change, you've got to balance the budget, et cetera, and that's the right way to look at this.
That is it. Yes. Yes.
It's obvious to you, I'm sure.
No. I mean, Gary can speak to that, and there are others in the room. I think that is a useful way of looking at this problem. Yes.
I would put it in.
But
Mark's point and Mike's point is that it's probably not just a one-way connection. Everybody, you know, has talked for 20 years about, longer, going back to the Olympics, about the influence of climate change on hurricanes, but Mike's point, and it does have a pedigree, just that it may go both ways, that there may be feedback of these storms in the climate system. And it is a somewhat more recent endeavor, which is why we have all these different ideas about. I don't think we're playing games.
I meant this to be a non-controversial question. Apparently there aren't any.
There's been for some time, to my knowledge, a desire to understand to close the heat bucket in the atmosphere. So for many years there was the long-standing problem of the missing petawatt. And so the atmosphere does maybe 60%, the ocean does maybe 40%, the ocean does it between, say, equator and 30 degrees, or equator and 40, the atmosphere takes it from the terminus of the Hadley cell, and the baroclinic waves transported further northward to the pole. But there's still kind of a missing petawatt, so Kerry has suggested perhaps that this is a missing petawatt. Kerry's a factor of 2 off, it's still pretty important, it's still pretty significant. Okay, it's a factor of 10 off, and it's a noise. So it's, you know, it's a factor of 10 to off. Okay, other questions, comments?
Okay, now, all right, so I hope that some of the people that are not familiar with these fields, field in particular, be a little bit more comfortable. I'm not going to talk too much in my lectures on number two, as Jim suggested. I'm kind of bowing to climate because we live in it, we're going to be killed by it. So we have to accept it and understand it, but it's a very fascinating problem. And I want to focus primarily on some aspects under item one. Bjorn has suggested that I didn't teach him anything at CSU. That's fine.
You've got an hour and a half now.
So, okay. So what I want to talk about today, and I'm collaborating with several people in the room, and Roger Smith and I have somewhat coordinated our talks. My first talk today is on fundamental aspects of hurricane dynamics. Part one, Roger's talk, which I believe is tomorrow morning, or maybe it's today or tomorrow. He's talking about fundamental aspects of hurricane dynamics, part two, and then I will pick up, address some fundamental aspects of hurricane dynamics, part three. Of course, Kerry and Wayne Schubert will cover other aspects, and Isaac Kell and several others who have just forgotten, for example, Andy Mida, they will cover other fundamental aspects of general circulation and vortex dynamics. So we're going to get a pretty good perspective on this problem many different angles, okay? So what I want to start off with is first part of my talk, I want to talk about just genesis. The genesis problem is the perhaps the greatest problem of, I think, one of the greatest problems of tropical meteorology. It's still an enigma. How do hurricanes form? How are they born? What conditions create them? Why don't we see more of them? Let me give you an example as to why this problem would be is of interest in the climate connection. If you run general circulation models, which are large computer models to represent fluid motions in the atmosphere over the whole globe, typically general circulation models are not able to resolve convective structures, definitely not, and typically not able to resolve hurricanes. What the large-scale general circulation models predict, they often predict, because they cannot represent convection or hurricane or, to some extent, tropical waves, though Dave Randall's going to talk a bit about a way perhaps around that impasse. What they often do is they predict too many storms. These large-scale models, general circulation models, often predict too many storms. So by a factor of something, too many. So these models are doing something that nature doesn't allow. Okay? And so if you're going to try to get a handle on what is the influence of increase in CO2, we're now up to around 360 parts per million in the atmosphere, 360, 370, what if that goes to 500? What are we going to do when it continues to climb, which is inevitably will? What type of prediction can we make, and how reliable are those predictions? How will the climate change? How will the tropical environment change? Will there be more storms? There are many people who live in the tropics. Okay, this is a societal impacts problem. Many people live in the tropics. We're going to have to better prepare for the coming deluge, if you will. But if general circulation models get it wrong, and they're off by a factor of two in the number of storms they predict, those hurricane circulations in the tropics will dominate the tropical circulation and will probably bias the tropical circulations largely. So you may not have very much confidence at all in predicting what's going to happen in that situation. Yes?
I'd just like to know,
since
you see storms, how do you decide if there's a storm? Yeah. How do you predict this number of storms?
Well, the GCM has shortcuts built into it for how the atmosphere is supposed to work in terms of how the convection is supposed to work. So if you have warm bubbles in the lower troposphere, warm bubbles rise, okay, because they're more locally buoyant. But those warm bubbles also have downdrafts associated with them. And there's precipitation in the atmosphere, the precipitation walls evaporatively cools the air. Now, you have to get all those combinations right.
So, but what do you get? How do most people infer the statistics of hurricanes?
Was that the question? Just how do I count the number of storms in the GCM? Well, there are various ways to do it.
But there is also the question of, I think there's some confusion here, because you said the models don't resolve tropical storms, and
yes,
yet there's something that counts.
Yes. Yes, so basically you would probably you could do it by wind maximum, vorticity maximum, low pressure.
So there,
you could try.
There's just enough resolution to get something.
Yeah.
But not to resolve it at its full intensity.
In very high resolution simulations that people have been doing, if you look at these old cloud resolving models that the Japanese have been making.
Matsuno and others, yes.
They're just remarkable in the number of cyclones.
I agree.
Hurricanes.
I agree.
Shooting up everywhere.
What was it? I just read a quote that Matsuno referred to the middle latitude as the vorticity dominated world of turbulence and stiff, and the tropics being the world dominated by tropical waves and convection, much more malleable and evanescent. That's poetry. I want to talk a little bit more.
I wanted to comment because I think there's too much made in the simulation and what they are. This is important to the applied people who are here. People talk about, you know, a few kilometer grid resolution. A few kilometer grid resolution doesn't mean a few kilometer grid spacing doesn't mean a few kilometer grid resolution. So the resolution you have is not your grid spacing. And in particular, these are simulator simulations that show this enormous number of huge hurricanes have deep convective towers, and this is Brian Mapes looked at the data in detail, have deep convective towers that are 36 kilometers thick. And typical for the non-experts, deep convective towers should be 1 kilometer, 2 kilometers thick. So don't.
I'm going to put a little back pressure on you now.
That's fine.
That's a simplification.
So
that's an oversimplification.
A really important issue is numerical methods that convert not your mesh resolution into 10 delta x, but numerical methods that convert your mesh resolution into 2 delta x. And it seems to me the Earth simulator resolution ones, which are done by not very sophisticated numerics, are 10 delta x, not 2 delta x. And they're biasing enormously. You've got deep convection happening on 37 kilometer regions uniformly, you're biasing for getting.
But their 10 delta X is still about 3 or 4 times better than other people's delta X.
No, but I'm comparing it to the cloud resolving model simulations people do on smaller.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to, and Andy's point is that the larger scale, the coarser ones aren't even trying to resolve the collection, parameterizing it. And there's an issue about whether resolve convection that's relatively coarse, and the Earth simulator is doing something bizarre, very even parameterized.
Absolutely.
Well, I think we can agree there's a myriad of scales that it has to confront. And if I put on my mathematician hat now, it's a multi-scale problem. And this is why we need people looking at various approaches in the convection wave problem. And we need people looking at the output of these models critically. Just as people look at the output of general circulation models, I've been told that Randall has told me that for several years. They actually have a model intercomparison project. They look at their models and they keep themselves in check. We should be doing the same thing. Okay, so let me just continue. This is one of my favorite transparencies. It's from Ed Lorenz, who's a giant in our field. There's no question, in my opinion. And the title of the paper is there's a title, Maximum Simplification of Dynamic Equations. But in the introduction, he tries to motivate why you might want to reduce the complexity of a problem to its essence. Okay. Sounds like a noble charge. And pertinent to us is the reduction of the physics of hurricanes, whether it be the large-scale waves that perhaps generate them or generate their conditions, or whether it be the convective structures that are interacting and forming a mesoscale self-sustaining vortex. This problem that Ed Lorenz goes through, it's actually quite nice. I'm just going to read it out loud. Pardon me for reading it, but I know you've already probably read it because I've had it up here. In order to make the best attainable forecast of the future weather, it would be desirable to express the physical laws as exactly as possible. Determine the initial conditions as precisely as possible. Yet the ultimate achievement of producing perfect forecasts by applying equations already known to be exact to initial conditions already known to be precise, if such a feat were possible, would not by itself increase our understanding of the atmosphere, no matter how important it might be from other considerations. For example, if we should observe a hurricane, we might ask ourselves, why did this hurricane come? If we could determine the exact condition at an earlier time, and if we could feed those conditions together with programming for integrating the exact equations into an electronic computer, we should in time, due time, receive a forecast from the computer which would show the presence of a hurricane. We then might still be justified in asking, why did the hurricane fall? The answer that the physical laws required a hurricane to form from the given antecedent conditions might not satisfy. Since we are aware of that, we were aware of that fact even before integrating the equations. It is only when we use systematically imperfect equations or initial conditions that imperfect initial conditions that we can begin to gain further understanding of the phenomenon which we observe. For if we omit the terms representing specified physical processes, such as friction, from the equations, or if we fail to include certain observable features such as cloudiness, the initial conditions, we may, by comparing the mathematical solutions with reality, gain some insight concerning the relative importance of the retained and omitted features. Of course, in so doing, we forego the opportunity of simultaneously making the best attainable forecast. I think this is still very pertinent today. The paper was published in 1960. Wine ages well with time. This is another example. Okay, there's, for the people that are not in meteorology or oceanography, the people that are in mathematics, there's a constant struggle. There's a good tension, typically, between operational forecasters and the theoretical dynamical community. There's a constant push-pull. Forecasters want to make a better forecast, and they want to include everything to make sure they have the right data to make an accurate forecast for tomorrow's weather or next week's weather. The theoretician or the dynamicist want to understand what's controlling the forecast. They want to know what makes the weather what it is. And so this is, in order to make progress in understanding a problem, we often have to forgo complexity. Because in a famous quote by Ian James in his book, Roger likes this also, is that you include everything in the model, that's an admission of failure. Okay, absolute complexity is an admission of failure. Okay. I don't think I need to preach that to the mathematicians in the room, because simplicity is what beauty of mathematics is. And the pursuit of mathematics is for the pursuit of mathematics and basic knowledge. The applications come for the ride; they come for free. So I want to just give an overview. I got an hour, so I'm going to talk a little bit about some problems, as I indicated in my abstract. But here is kind of what I viewed as hot topics about 4 years ago. I think it was 5 years ago at the ASP, where I gave some lectures in Boulder. The list hasn't changed too much. I've just listed them here in terms of hurricanes. Okay, for hurricane lingo, we got spiral bands and precipitation. Precipitation structures, interactions of hurricanes with vertical shear. Okay, vertical shear can modulate precipitation. Kristen Corbacero is going to talk a little bit about that on tomorrow. Okay, hurricanes, intense hurricanes undergo what we call concentric life cycles, concentric eyewall life cycles. They typically, like when they get very strong, typically spawn secondary and tertiary eyewalls. Okay? And these secondary and tertiary eyewalls are often predictors of weakening episodes of the main hurricane. And forecasters at the National Hurricane Center are very interested in knowing whether or not a storm is undergoing a concentric eye cycle, because they typically associate that with a weakening of the primary winds between 10 and 20 meters per second. Something like that on time scales of hours, 6 to 12 hours. And then there's often a recovery of those winds as the outer eyewall contracts inward and replaces the inner eyewall. Okay? these are hot topics because the fluid dynamics and convective dynamics, okay, are not well understood. Okay? That's why I'm listening here, just to give an overview. Eyewall mesovortices, these have come out a little bit more lately in the literature. We see them more because basically our observing instruments are much better than they were 10 years ago. And they're definitely much better than they were 20 years ago. And we now have rapid time imagery almost every minute, every several minutes with GOES. We can actually see these structures in the eyes of these storms, and they're fascinating. Okay?
So,
but they've been around since a lot of time, just as the moon has been around. Yes.
Mike, maybe you should supply a little sketch for what an eyewall vortex means.
That's a good, just a sketch on the board?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I had all this material prepared this morning. We need it. So,
a rough sketch.
Okay, a rough sketch would be typically in a hurricane, once it's fully formed, if you plot the vorticity, okay, as a function of radius, vorticity being in cylindrical coordinates, vorticity being a combination of curvature term and shear term. Right, this is a partial derivative. Plot that as a function of radius. Typically, in a very strong storm, you're going to see a profile of vorticity that looks like this. So, if you look at it from a planar perspective, it looks like a ring. In the vorticity perspective, from the vorticity field, it looks like a ring of vorticity. Now, this would be the swirling circulation. So, this is the flow into the board. The tangential velocity flow into the board, which has an associated vorticity profile. Now, vorticity profiles like this, okay, in the absence of forcing mechanisms such as the secondary circulation, which is feeding the vortex with angular momentum, and it's also feeding the vortex with entropy from the underlying ocean. That's entropy input from the underlying ocean. In the absence of forcing, okay, and dissipation, this type of profile is generally very unstable. It's very unstable, okay? Because it satisfies Lord Rayleigh necessary condition for instability, curvilinear flow. For the fluid analysis in the audience, you would just say, oh, that's just Kelvin-Helmholtz. Fine. The atmospheric ocean dynamics, we call this barotropic instability. We distinguish it from baroclinic instability. And in this case, the vorticity gradient changes sign. In terms of linear theory, you take a ring, you jostle the ring just a little bit, give it a little perturbation, then there will be perturbations on that ring. Look down on it from above. Jostle the ring just a little bit. Okay? Jostle the exterior ring as well. Okay? There'll be perturbations on that ring that will grow. Perturbations will amplify. As the perturbations grow, just plot plot amplitude as a function of time. Just sketching this angle. So the perturbation in linear theory grows exponentially. We all know that nothing grows exponentially forever. So at some point, the linear instabilities will saturate, the ring of vorticity will break down, and it'll break down in pools of vorticity, discrete structures, vortices. Now, in the simple 2D model, okay, these eyewall mesovortices, these pools of vorticity are only transient because depending upon the situation, whether you have very narrow rings or if you have very broad rings. If you have very broad rings, then these eyewall mesovortices ultimately cool as well. So you see a beautiful demonstration of two-dimensional turbulence, inverse energy cascade. And the downward entropy cascade for thick rings. For thin rings, actually, these vortices So, you basically, the nonlinear evolution, you can either get crystal-like solutions, frozen crystals, vortex crystals, or monopoles. A picture, just to give you an example. So, can I use my overhead just for a second? Great. So here's an example of what they look like. This is a picture taken from, it's an overlay of the lower fuselage radar taken on board the NOAA P3. As the NOAA P3 flew through Hurricane Isabel on the 13th of September, I was on that flight. And this is a MODIS image taken from a satellite picture overlaid with the lower fuselage radar. So the MODIS image brings out the low-level swirls in the stratocumulus deck in the eye. Stratocumulus deck may be 2 to 3 kilometers thick. And you can see these very pronounced, intense swirling motions inside the eye of the storm. Okay.
It might be helpful just to give a rough radial or horizontal scale.
This is like roughly 90 kilometers across, okay? And this would be something on the order of a couple hundred kilometers across, 200-300 kilometers across. So I'm not looking at the full circulation from the satellite. I'm just looking at a zoomed-in view. And so these would be examples of these IWO mesovortices in a more sustained and forced configuration in which these circulations, in fact, were observed to exist and evolve over a period of almost 2 days. Okay? And it's caught the fascination of many people, including Wayne Schubert, myself, and others have been working on this problem.
So the mesovortices are in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
Because the eye wall would be the red ray, I guess, right? That's the deep convection.
Yeah, so the reflectivity basically gives the amount of return from electromagnetic radiation emitted from a radar on board an aircraft. The higher the return, because the more extent of rain, it's raining a lot, you get a higher return in your signal. So all I'm showing here is a colored rendition of basically reflected power.
So I'm a little bit.
So dark red is the radar ring, and these lighter red regions, I haven't given a color scale here, this is like 40 dBz. For the radar people in the room. And this is more like 20 to 30 dBz. These are more the weaker banding type motions you're seeing in the extremity here.
So those mesovortices.
Are you learning something yet?
Well, yeah, I'm learning something. the thing I'm a little puzzled about is the shallow cloud features are often good at illuminating circulations, but sometimes they can make very dramatic pictures from very tepid circulations. So example, weight flow behind an ion, and if you're there, it wouldn't be a particularly vigorous circulation.
Well,
it looks rich and fascinating in the cloud features. And so in the eye, how do we know that they're vigorous mesovortices rather than...
Well, because we've measured some of the circulations in the eye.
Yeah.
Because they occasionally cause airplanes to crash.
And because they occasionally cause airplanes to crash, and we almost lost one in 1989 in Hurricane Hugo. We believe that the airplane flew through one of these very small-scale structures, not kind of a vortex-scale mesovortex, but one of these little small critters running right around on the inside of the eye wall, the inside of the radar band. And these things were like little tornadoes. Okay? So if you want to study a problem that's got tornadoes, mesovortices, hurricanes, great problem. It's got it all in here. Got little tornadoes too. Okay? Now, the more interesting question, okay, practically, these things are dangerous. You want to fly through these things. We've come to learn, and NOAA no longer flies below 10,000 feet unless they have specific objectives in mind, but they typically do not fly inside the storm or in the eyewall region below 10,000 feet anymore. Okay? Not anymore, because they almost lost. So if you're going to fly through one of these things, don't fly in the lowest 2 kilometers, because the vortex stretching there is the strongest anywhere in the atmosphere, except for tornadoes. So don't fly through there, because that's a danger zone. And these things are just waiting to wrap your plane into a little foil. Yeah.
So is it fair to say that every hurricane that's mature with the modern instrumentation shows these intense mesial vortices, or are there some that don't?
I think that it would be fair to say that at a certain stage in these intense hurricanes' life cycle, every hurricane will show these. The question of whether or not these structures are important at the very early stages of a mature storm is an open question. Okay, I think Wayne has some insight on that now. Okay, so this is just one of my hot topics. Okay, this is one. Okay, gotta go back to my list. So, convective hot towers. What's going on? It's a hot tower. Well, it's a tower, cloud. Why do I call it a hot tower? Well, because the temperature inside these clouds is warmer than in their immediate environment. So these clouds are locally buoyant. Okay? That's why I call these hot towers. They're towers because they penetrate all the way to the tropopause. So the mathematicians in the audience, the tropopause in the tropics is somewhere above 15 kilometers typically. It's higher. Depending on how close the equator you are. The hot towers basically are pushing the tropopause up. We don't have typically hot towers in the mid latitudes. Occasionally you'll have winter storms that may produce something like hot towers. And you have summertime storms through supercells, and those guys go all the way into the tropopause and beyond, into the stratosphere. Okay, but the convective hot towers were long ago implicated in the Halley cell in trying to explain how the heat is transported from the equator equatorial region to the subtropics. So why is this a hot topic? Hasn't it been all solved? Isn't it done? Figured out, right? It's a done problem. Solved. Nope. Because these hot towers, basically, in regions where hurricanes form, where there's already pre-existing vorticity, these hot towers can actually, they do possess very intense vorticity. So they actually rotate. They're not necessarily supercells, not as strong as supercells, but they are rotating clouds. Okay? And these hot towers I'm talking about, they're not going to be a kilometer across. Okay, these things are probably more like 10 to 20 kilometers across. Okay? In order to get something from the top of the boundary layer to the tropopause, you've got to start off with something bigger than 1 kilometer. That's why I was putting a little back pressure. Because clouds, as they rise in the atmosphere, they entrain. They entrain dry air from the sides. So in order to protect a cloud to go from the top of the boundary layer to the tropopause, you have to have it either be large enough, or you have to have some rotation. The rotation provides both inertial and Rossby elasticity to protect these clouds. So these are big convection turrets. These are not little small things. The small guys don't make it very far. Small guys are the shallow cumulus. Shallow cumulus doesn't make a hurricane. Deep cumulus is required for hurricanes, not shallow cumulus. Okay? All right. Air-sea interaction. Well, the sea state in hurricanes is quite complicated. I have a picture, but I'm not going to show it. Gary will show some more of this, I hope. At very high wind speeds, the waves get very large in amplitude, and the waves break. They spew foam. There's often this little layer, may not be very little, maybe actually quite thick, where the foam becomes almost as if it's a fluid. It's almost like it's an emulsion or a two-phase flow. Okay? It's a very fascinating problem in basic physics, in high-speed aerodynamics. Okay, genesis is a hot topic. I'm going to talk about that now. And climate warming scenarios. So we kind of talked a little bit about that in the beginning. Okay. Let's just talk a little bit about the facts as we know them. This is the picture taken, borrowed from one of Bill Gray's papers.
showing the predicted, well, this is what he calls a genesis parameter. It's a genesis parameter for identifying the regions that are most prone to forming tropical cyclones and hurricanes. Okay. Here's the equator. Here are the continents. Okay, latitude is up down here. And you can see this genesis parameter that he's developed, which I'm not going to go into, and Gary's going to basically revise that. Okay. Shows hurricanes in the eastern, western Atlantic, eastern Pacific. These are the offs. I should just focus on that. I get so distracted by this. Western, eastern Atlantic, eastern Pacific, northwest Pacific, Indian, Arabian Sea, southern hemisphere, Australian region, and South Pacific. Okay? So that's kind of where the storms are favored to form. Notice there's no storms forming in the South Atlantic. For those of you that are brand new to this field, you might say, that's odd. I'm not going to get into that today. Okay, so where do these storms come from? Well, I've been working recently with a new colleague, Zuo Wong. Is she here today? And Tim Dunkerton. And we're basically revisiting the problem of the origin of tropical cyclones in the current climate. And as a very basic zero-order cut, this problem, what we just did was, what Zuo did was she just took the NSEP analyses. Okay, I mean, the NSEP analyses, I'm going to have to do this more, so I'm going to have to get people spun up. The NSEP analyses are a comprehensive data set that can generate, incorporate all of the available observations over land, over water, ships, buoys, aircraft, into one comprehensive data set, combining it into a usable data set for the past 40 years to study processes as climate, interannual variability, various topics. Okay, we're going to use that data set just to look at the variance of meridional wind. Okay, so it's the wind that goes north-south, okay, which is a proxy for tropical wave activity. Tropical waves typically have a meridional wind, the exception being the Kelvin wave. Kelvin waves are at the Florida. They live right on the equator, the K wave. So let's just talk about the waves that are off of the equator. And look at the meridional wind. We're contouring that in terms of the variance. So, you know, you take the square root of that to get meters per second. And then we're going to superimpose on that genesis locations as recorded in the best track data. Okay? Well, it's interesting to point out. That the regions of storm formation in the deep tropical regions, which let's just say are south of 20 degrees north, okay, the Gulf storms in the Gulf of Mexico and over here in the eastern U.S. and these more higher latitude storms in the North Pacific, let's not consider those for the moment. Let's just talk about what we call the deep tropical, the canonical tropical storms. Okay, these form in association with heightened wave activity. Okay? That's what that would suggest. This would suggest if you just look at, you just count them up, just take the frequency of vorticity in the analysis at 850 millibars, this was 850 millibars, exceeding a certain threshold. Now, of course, the NSEP analysis, you've got to be careful, they're all smooth. You're not going to see real vorticity when you observe it. You're going to see smooth vorticity. Because the resolution of this NSEP data is only on the order of, I believe it's 2.5 by 2.5 degrees. So it's going to be smooth. Okay? What do you see here? You see that these storm locations are located where the vorticity of the waves and the mean, I've added the time mean in here, where the vorticity and the mean exceed a certain threshold. So you've got the waves coming off the African continent, okay? Must be intimately connected to the tropical cyclogenesis. Now that's been known observationally for a long time. This is not new. This analysis is kind of new, but it's not new. Okay?
how do these waves, which I haven't pointed out and haven't discussed yet, in the Atlantic, Eastern Pacific, look at the Westpac, some of these waves are much closer to the equator than these waves here. These waves are more around 15 degrees north, 12 to 15 cluster. These guys are way down towards the equator. Must be a connection to tropical waves. How do the tropical waves create an environment for hurricane formation? That's a fascinating question. That's a question we're working on. I'm not going to talk about it because I don't have time. But I'm just going to set the problem up that waves in our current climate create environments with heightened vorticity, okay, and heightened humidity for the formation of these storms. Well, the vorticity's got to come from somewhere. The problem is, planetary vorticity is too weak. Omega for the Earth is 7.2, times 10 to the minus 5. In the tropics, your Coriolis parameter is on the order of 2 to 3 times 10 to the minus 5. Okay? That's too small. The vorticity in hurricanes is 2 orders of magnitude larger. So you've got to boost that vorticity by at least 2 orders of magnitude. So the question was vorticity, debris. The vorticity seems to be intimately connected with the waves. Okay. And the waves must create an environment favorable for the formation of hurricanes. Now, the reason why this, the answer or the story is not simple, okay, I'm just going to basically cut to the chase because I want to get onto some of the material. I've just been giving an overview so far. The waves themselves are 2,500, let's say, for the easterly waves, for the simple example. The West Pacific is more complex. The easterly waves are like 2,500 kilometers in wavelength. Zonal wavelength. Okay? They're quite large. Okay, they're large waves. Hurricanes are mesoscale phenomena. Several hundred kilometers at their birth stage. So either the waves are somehow magically contracting down to 100 kilometers, which I don't buy, or they're doing something else more subtle. Because the waves themselves, on various analyses, if you look at the various jets for the easterly jet, I'm not going to go into the details. These dashed contours are zonal wind. Solid contours are potential temperature. Okay, this is potential vorticity. Okay, we'll get into that a little bit later. Basically, when you take this jet, just like your Kelvin-Helmholtz problem, it's not a curvilinear problem, it's a zonal problem on the sphere, and you tweak it a little bit, jitter it a little bit. Take your jet, jitter it. The growth rates that come out of that calculation for realistic jet flows, let's look at the numbers. Somewhere between like 0.2 and 0.35 inverse days. So that means to get an E-folding, you've got to go 3 days. By that time, the wave has already left Africa and it's over the Western Atlantic because they move at about 6 degrees latitude per day. Okay, so in 3 days, it's moved 20 degrees longitude. They grow too slow, and in fact, even this experiment, in order to do it right, if you're going to be honest with no tricks, you've got to initialize the jet with random noise, then you've got to let the jet evolve. If you're going to do this life cycle paradigm, you've got to let the jet evolve through many e-foldings in order to see the most unstable wave number emerge. That's going to take 10 or 12 or 15 e-foldings. Now we're talking 30 to 45 days. It's irrelevant. The growth rate of the waves is not the description, it's not in my mind the way that these waves form hurricanes.
That may be true, but there's a large literature on whether it's ever appropriate or mathematical closure to take a time and mean state to assess the stability of the natural flow. Of course, that time and mean state reflects the
yes.
feedback and the perturbations on the flow.
Correct. Correct.
Maybe that's the
Some of this has been done more carefully by Nick Hall and George Galatis recently, where they've actually taken the NSEP analyzed mean fields looked at the stability analysis of the headset flows in the CMWF model. Okay, again, they find that the growth rates of these waves is too weak. Okay. It's too slow. So, why am I building up to this? Because something's missing. That's why.
Right. You're arguing. Okay.
What? My argument's messed.
Your slide already.
Please help me out, because then I don't have to show.
Not direct initiation by any of these waves.
No.
I don't think anyone makes sense. So,
but no one in the community now, except for the people that are not in the community, but the audience, no one. So rather than have them read the literature and try to see if the waves themselves initiate the hurricanes, I'd rather have them not waste their time and understand that the waves provide an important role in providing a favorable environment. Precisely how that works is not yet understood.
I think one thing I might interject to say to the non-specialists is that most people, maybe everybody in our community, believes that hurricanes don't arise spontaneously in our climate. They're finite amplitude instabilities. They literally do need to be triggered to help us arise out of random fluctuations.
Thank you very much. Okay, so now I'm ready.
They need that preconditioned environment of which kind.
Right. So what? Yes. In the current climate. That's fine. If you run a model long enough and you run it with coarse enough resolution, you're going to find hurricanes without waves. I have no problem with that. Okay. I'm sorry. Maybe. I'd be real surprised. I'm sure you're going to show me that that's going to happen, but I'll be real skeptical, and we can discuss. But in the current climate, what we see is these hurricanes forming within the trough region of these waves. Well, the easterly wave is kind of our canonical example. And within the trough region, this is 2,500 kilometers, maybe this is 700 kilometers across, you have these regions of enhanced convection, convective blowups, in other words. And within those regions of enhanced convection, the convection basically builds through a combination of deep convection and stratiform convection, which I'm not going to go into in detail here. I don't have time. I'm ready to do the PowerPoint now, if that's all right. The convection builds. These are the collaborators. They all know who they are, and there some of them are in the audience. The convection builds this, what we call a mesoscale convective vortex. Okay, the mesoscale convective vortex comes about, it's believed to come about, through a stratiform, primarily a stratiform mode of convection, not the deep convective mode where the heating profile is a maximum in the mid-troposphere, but more of a heating profile, which is what they call top-heavy. It's skewed towards the upper atmosphere, and you have a little bit of cooling in the lower troposphere coming from evaporative cooling. Okay? That heating profile is conducive to providing very weak but persistent convergence in middle levels of the troposphere between 4 and, say, 6 kilometers. Okay? So what I've done, or what we've done in some of our modeling studies, and we haven't just used this mesoscale convective vortex, where we're using we're taking the perspective that, okay, the convection within the wave itself, the wave is providing a favorable environment for convection. The convection within the wave, okay, provides what we call an embryo. It provides a preconditioned environment that has some vorticity, okay, cyclonic vorticity. The cyclonic vorticity is elevated. There's perhaps no vorticity at the surface, no relative vorticity at the surface initially. But we're going to start this simulation off here where we have a little bit of vorticity at the surface. Say our winds are 3 meters per second. And we have winds at, say, 6 meters per second at around 4 kilometer altitude. Now, so the question is, how do you go from this type of configuration to this, which is the full-fledged hurricane circulation, contracted radius of maximum winds, more importantly, winds that are maximum at the surface. Okay, and of course you have inflow and outflow to supply it, inflow of angular momentum, that is, to supply it, and you must have heat supply, and we'll get to that in a little bit. So, just to fuel the debate a little bit, the thermal structure of these vorticity anomalies, that the convection, that is like what you would call a byproduct of the convection, is mesoscale convective vortices. It's cold in the lower troposphere. This is some PowerPoint stupidity here. Cold here, warm there. Okay, but in the lower troposphere, it's cold core. So the temperature deviation, if you take a thermometer and you fly through one of these things, you may see a temperature depression of maybe 1 degree, maybe 2 centigrade, relative to the environment. That's important. And I think Kerry's going to talk about that as well in his lecture in a few days. So you have this rotation, and you have basically the coldness underneath the mesoscale convective vortex. And we published a paper in 2006 where we refer to this as a convective embryo. It's an embryo for the convection because it's a preconditioned environment. In what way? It's preconditioned in two ways. One is it has some initial rotation. So it already has some initial rotational stiffness, okay? Some Rossby elasticity as well. But it has another, it plays another role in preconditioning, and that is the lapse rates are slightly steeper in the center than in the environment. So convection is going to tend to be predisposed to occur within the MCV, if you can create it, than on the outskirts, okay? Now, okay, so I've shown you the wind. I'm going to show you the thermodynamic profile used to initiate the vortex. We're going to use the Jordan mean sounding. Here's the temperature as a function of pressure. Here's the dew point temperature. It's the temperature you must cool the air at constant pressure to achieve saturation. The dew point temperature is slightly depressed, okay, relative to the observed temperature in the lower troposphere. But of course, it's much drier in the middle troposphere. Okay, it's much drier there. Okay, so if you want to saturate the column, you've got to basically bring this dew point depression curve. You've got to get that right in near that red curve. Okay. So this is the difference
between the red curve down to the blue.
Or bring the red curve down to the blue curve. You can do it two ways. Exactly. That's exactly right. So we're just showing the comparison of our model initial conditions with observations. This is our non-sal environment, which you can take by looking at the difference between two microwave channels. You kind of pick out where the Saharan air layer is that comes off of Africa. The point of the Saharan air layer is that it's dry. I don't think necessarily that it's dusty, but it's more that it's dry. Okay, but it's dry here, moist there. This is non-Saharan air layer air. If you look at the model data, whether it's in mixing ratio or in relative humidity, it's close to the observations. It's within the observational error in any way. Now, we've done a whole series of experiments, and I'm not going to describe all these. Cloud resolving, I use that term, probably I abuse it. It's not cloud resolving, it's cloud representing. It's 2 kilometer grid spacing or 3 kilometer grid spacing. If you want to do cloud resolving, you've got to do 100 meters or something, okay? As Andy talked about a little while ago. Okay, but at least the convection is explicit. So you're not parameterizing, so you're not imposing tricks on the convection, how the convection gets triggered, how the convection is initiated, how it interacts with the large-scale environment. You're letting the basic physics determine that. Of course, the tricks, if you will, are pushed to another level of complexity. They're pushed down into the microphysics, so how the water conversions take place and how rapidly they take place via evaporation, condensation, etc. I'm not going to go into the details. I only have 25 minutes left. I have 2 topics left to cover. So I'm going to apply the trick that one physicist professor taught me. If you push stuff through fast enough over a little hole, it falls in. It's the relativistic contraction effect, right? So we're going to go from our mid-level MCV, okay? And we want to ask the question, how does it intensify? Well, let's do something simple. First, let's run the model. And let's compute 2 quantities that are often computed. Okay, one would be the surface pressure. Everyone likes to know what the surface pressure is. What's the barometric reading today? So the surface pressure in the center of the storm, you can see over a time scale of 3 days, For the first 2 days, there's a little development here, maybe by 1 to 2 millibars. Then it increases, then it decreases, then it increases. No real systematic drop in the surface pressure for the first 2 days of this simulation. On the other hand, the relative humidity, which I described earlier, is, you can think of it as a measure between the dew point temperature and the sounding temperature. The relative humidity is increasing with time, starting at 5 kilometer height, starting at 55%, and it's climbing to approximately 85%. This is area averaged. This is averaged throughout the inner core region. So the inner core, I should be specific, is I think it's 100 kilometers in radius around the developing system. So it's like a 200 kilometer diameter disk. I just take the area average, okay? So the relative humidity is increasing. And so what you see is, as the relative humidity increases, you see the pressure drop rapidly. And perhaps you would say, genesis is when the column, or at least the middle levels, become sufficiently saturated.
And is it convecting during this time, all this time?
That's the point. I would argue it is not correct to say genesis, that the nearest column saturation is essential for genesis. I would argue that it's more important to talk about the lower troposphere relative humidity and whether or not there's convection occurring persistently over this time. And the convection occurring persistently will automatically raise the relative humidity of the middle levels. And that's what I'm going to show. The same simulation, what we see, if we look at the wind field, we see the transformation from cold core to warm core. The winds are now surface maximum at the ground, or at this ocean surface. For the non-specialist, this is important. Why? Because the ocean is a tremendous reservoir of energy. If you can get the winds high enough at the ocean surface, then you're going to be able to extract heat from the underlying ocean to fuel these strong storms. So you've got to get the wind strong at the surface. That's why I'm showing the plot. So what we see is, over a time scale of just 24 hours, the winds have already transformed. You've already gone from cold core to warm core. You basically formed a tropical depression within 24 hours. Whether it's 24 or 48, doesn't much matter. You get a hurricane. But how does it actually work? Oops. Don't do this to me now. All right. So now I'm going to show, oops. Why is it not showing the movie? No. It's on my PowerPoint. Why is it not showing it on the PowerPoint? If you come over just for a second, I have the movie here. It's not showing it on the PowerPoint.
Just turn the laptop around so it runs.
Not good enough. I've got you right where I want you. I'm not going to just show you the laptop. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to show this film, see if it works. I'm going to show that basically the vorticity is quite complicated. You see deep towers of vorticity. The towers grow, time scale of a day or two, or an hour or two. They converge relative vorticity. They intensify by two orders of magnitude. The towers don't last very long, however. They last maybe an hour or two. They leave behind debris of vorticity. The vorticity then conglomerates through upscale cascade or a quasi-merger type process. This is a much more complicated environment, however. This is not simple barotropic dynamics. It's three-dimensional. And what I'm showing here is theta E, okay,
the theta E, what you see here is this is a color diagram at the surface, mid-levels, upper troposphere, 197, 4 kilometers, 7 kilometers. The theta E you see is the towers form, they produce strong downdrafts. The downdrafts are present, absolutely. The downdrafts are localized. The downdrafts are rotationally confined, however, so they're not able to spread out into squall lines, what I would call gravitons. Andy's not here, so you see these theta E pockets of lower theta E air, okay? There's fluxes going on outside, okay? We've done this simulation without any fluxes at all, and we get the same behavior. So we'll talk about that later. You see these cold pools forming, the rising. This is the W contour. The rising motion is forced on the edge of these cold pools, so the convection tends to persist. It's protected, it's rotationally protected. There's a secondary circulation that's basically inhibiting the spread of these cold pools and the squall lines. Andy would like this.
I've seen it.
That's why you left. Okay, so there's convection occurring within this first 24 hours. That's what's saturating the column. You can look at statistics of the vorticity structures or any structure you'd like. These are highly skewed vorticity distributions. You have strong cyclone, anti-cyclone asymmetry, strong vortex tube stretching near the lower surface, predisposes the atmosphere to being cyclonic in these towers. Of course, you do have tilting. Tilting is symmetric with respect to cyclone and anti-cyclonic vorticity. But you have pre-existing cyclonic vorticity, so that tips the balance. That's like playing with loaded dice. So if your dice is loaded, okay, then this upscale cascade process would suggest this is the preferred route to genesis via bottom-up process. And we observe some of these structures. We observe these structures in real data from Doppler radar observations in a developing storm in the Caribbean. I won't go into details. The towers play a role in a couple ways. They skew the vorticity, so it's cyclonic, and they also provide a secondary circulation through heating in the Soria-Leeson equation. Heating creates in Roger Smith's terminology that he's going to present in his lecture, localized buoyancy anomaly, okay, and also a system scale buoyancy. So for the Soria-Leeson, we're talking more about system scale buoyancy that's producing an overturning circulation. The overturning circulation, I'm not talking about the Hadley cell, though you might argue there's some analogy between the Hadley cell and the hurricane meridional circulation. And Dumbarton and Oakwood-Worth have a nice paper on that. And monsoons. We're talking about a local Hadley cell within a hurricane. Okay? And you can compare the calculations, you run the balance model, you run the primitive equation model, and the vertical velocities and the azimuthal average, and in the radial velocities, you know, to the extent that you accept some disagreement locally on a broad scale. The agreement is actually quite remarkable. So the system scale, the vortex scale, is quasi-balanced. One MCV is enough. The transition occurs in hot towers. The saturation of the column occurs after genesis, during the intensification process in these simulations.
What is, you know, genesis is sort of
I use it in quotes. What do we mean by genesis? What's the definition of genesis? The way I define it is the birth of a warm core vortex that's self-sustaining. It's a warm core, that's a warm temperature anomaly, winds are strongest at the ground, and it's able to maintain itself. That's when you've given birth to a child. The child can now breathe on his own. The child can sustain himself with some water, some food.
And you can still fall down the stairs, right? And
of course,
still,
of course.
You don't, I mean, because one of the questions underlies this is how many hurricanes do we have in a given year? So from that point of view, is genesis when something reaches hurricane intensity?
Interestingly, that's an excellent question. The once you get to tropical depression stage, you often go to hurricane stage. But it's very difficult to get to that tropical depression stage.
Do you see that if you look like...
You see it in the data.
Disturbance pressures? Do you
I guess, hang on. We don't have that much. We don't have the data to that time resolution over open ocean regions where we don't have aircraft. We have to infer it with proxy data or whatever. You see it when you look at the forecasters and look at how they assimilate all the information when they're on the bench. And they take great efforts, I think, to distinguish between tropical depressions and just tropical storm or tropical disturbances that can't get there. They're usually pretty careful when they give it a TD status, or they give it a named status, maybe that's the more appropriate term. When they give it a named status, they have a lot of insight and wisdom, experience suggesting that it's going to go to a certain stage. It's already past the genesis stage. So it's precisely what that criterion is mathematically. You know, it should be Galilean invariant. It should be based on Lagrangian quantities. I don't know. But that's a great question to understand. Okay, now I have 10 minutes and I want to discuss something that I've been working on with someone else, with Roger and his PhD student Sang. And I want to take 10 minutes, I'm going to take my full 10 minutes, to revisit not just the genesis problem, but the intensification problem. I want to revisit it because I don't think it's sufficiently well understood. Roger doesn't either. And Sang has been working very hard with me at the Naval Postgrad School since October, right, Sang? And we almost have a paper that we're ready to submit, and I wanted to summarize a little bit of the content of the paper. What we want to do is, how are we going to revisit it? What's the big deal? Hurricanes strengthen, so what? What's the big deal? Well, the models that have been used to understand the strengthening of a tropical storm have been axisymmetric, primarily. The theoretical models that have been used have been axisymmetric. The paradigm that we have for understanding how storms intensify from their tropical depression storm stage is axisymmetric, okay? We're learning more about the asymmetries in tropical cyclones and how asymmetries interact with the convection, how they modulate the convection, how they modulate the intensity. It's, I think, natural to ask how the asymmetries play in the intensification problem. Do they play any role? Or is it just kind of noise that we don't need to worry about? We can just azimuthally average the answer and we get the same result. Well, the answer to that is no, in my opinion, and Roger's. So what we want to do is revisit this in three dimensions, okay? I'm going to show you just a little bit of the control run that we do from a prototype problem. So the prototype problem is starting from a weak tropical storm, 15 meter per second vortex with a radius of maximum wind of 150 kilometers. Just plop it down into a model atmosphere, okay? We're going to run this in the Lorenz fashion. We're going to strip the model from all of its complexity. We're going to allow the model to interact with convection by just one way. We're going to allow any latent heat that's released because parcels of air are reaching their condensation temperature. We're going to allow that latent heat to release. We're not going to allow precipitation to fall and cool the air. We're not going to worry about radiation because we're talking about finite time experiments. Okay? And we're going to allow an interaction between the atmosphere and the ocean through a very simple boundary layer called bulk aerodynamic boundary layer. Okay? No tricks. Okay? No tricks. Very simple. Okay? But it's going to be three dimensions. Three-dimensional. So what we've done, let me just...
What's your grid resolution?
We're going to use 5 kilometers right now.
Okay.
We're doing this at... we've done some simulations at 1.67. And we were going to do this at, like, say, a couple hundred meters, but that's too much for one paper. We'll write another paper. Do that. Here's the simulation summarized here. Here's wind speed over here on the left. Start from 15 meter per second vortex. Here's pressure, surface pressure, minimum, on the right. Okay. Broadly speaking, starts off at 15 meters a second. Takes a while to get going. Takes about 10 hours. Okay. We know what that is. That's basically moistening the lower boundary layer. That's, Carrie Emanuel has talked about that and demonstrated that quite nicely. That's our gestation time to moisten the boundary layer. Okay. Then the vortex starts to intensify. But notice that the local winds, okay, intensify very rapidly first. And then the system scale winds, or the azimuthal average winds,
intensify second. Okay? So this looks like a reasonable evolution. We look at the low-level mean relative humidity, look at the mid-level mean relative humidity. It's T equals zero. You can see the low-level humidity is moistening to about 90%. The mid-level mean relative humidity is also moistening up to about 70%. But it tracks with the increase in winds. Okay? It doesn't occur first. It occurs simultaneous to the increase in winds. Now, I hope this works, Sam. I'm going to show the movie of the relative vorticity field at 850 millibars. Now, I would have shown the other movie of the Genesis, but there's strong similarities between our Genesis simulation and the intensification simulation. Is that a surprise to most of you? No, I hope not. It's not a surprise to me. What do we see in the evolution? And I'm going to play this movie a couple times. Okay. So at these resolutions, 5 kilometer grid spacing, basically we see initially a broad monopole vorticity distribution. And the convergence in the boundary layer, the Ekman convergence in the boundary layer, produces rising motion and it lifts parcels to their level of free convection. Okay, very quickly, after it's reached near saturation during that gestation time. And the convection breaks out in a ring. The ring of convection, it's too long of a movie, it'll come back to the beginning in a second. The ring of convection produces dipoles in the vorticity because, as I said, there's tilting. Of course there's tilting. But there's more cyclonic vorticity than anticyclonic. The cyclonic vorticity then starts to merge with neighboring cyclonic vorticity anomalies, and you go from a ring of approximately 12 cyclone, anticyclone dipoles to 8, then to 4, and so you get an upscale cascade. The upscale cascade now consolidates to an approximate monopole where it would appear that we have vortex Rossby waves propagated on the waveguide of the mean PV gradient, kind of like your stratospheric vortex, but now it's a moistened stratospheric vortex. It's in the tropics. It's your surf zone, if you like. It's converted itself into a surf zone with axisymmetrizing filaments. But notice that at long times, the vortex is never axisymmetric. It always is asymmetric. It starts highly asymmetric, and it upscale cascades to a lower degree of asymmetry, but the asymmetry is still persistent. Okay, I'm going to play the movie again. I know this is a very simple experiment, but I think it's also very helpful to understand the basic fluid dynamics of this process of how intense vortices
interact. What did you initialize with? Was this some kind of random seed? Or didn't look like it? I don't know if you showed the initial.
In this case, there's no random seed. It's an axisymmetric distribution of humidity, but we're going to randomize it in just about 30 seconds. Okay, so you can see how this upscale cascades and builds. The cyclonic vorticity conglomerates. The anticyclonic vorticity, by the way, it's the light blue, it's pushed out. It's expelled from the cyclonic core. Okay, it pushes it out. Let me go to the next slide. Now, if we're going to understand, I forgot the third reason.
We're going to hold you to your time.
Yeah, I know you are.
It's a long morning.
If you want to do accurate forecasts, okay, save lives after the Katrina disaster, okay, then you better understand how to initialize these models. Because these models have an intrinsic degree of chaos in them. The solutions are intrinsically chaotic. If you initialize the vortex with small deviations in the relative humidity in the boundary layer, less than a half a gram per kilogram. The deviations you see are within a stochastic envelope. It's of great interest, in my opinion, theoretically, to determine what that envelope is. Because that tells us the range of uncertainty that we are going to have to live with to make accurate forecasts with any model. Okay? I don't care what model you're using, Worf or whatever model you're going to use. So we've done this with 10 ensemble members. When you look at the asymmetries of the vorticity distribution from the control and just 3 representative ensembles, the vorticity asymmetries, you just need to stare at them, look at them a little bit, are completely different in detail. The asymmetries are completely different. course, if you ask me the average and coarse grain it, you're going to see approximately the same axisymmetric vortex. But the details are quite different. The asymmetric structures are highly variable. That tells us that the asymmetries are inherently chaotic. But should we all go home? Does that mean we're done? If we're trying to forecast hurricanes, do we have to go down 100 meters? That seems a bit ridiculous. Isaac's going to show us results at much coarser resolution. Can we be smart about it? Yes. Maybe certain things are more predictable than others. For example, what does a forecaster want to know? He wants to know where the region of the highest damage is going to be. He wants to know how big the storm's going to be. Not just in terms of how big are the gale force winds. If you're in the Navy and you want to move your fleet from one port to another, you want to stay away from the region of 17 meter per second winds or higher. So that's the gale force radius. But if you're a forecaster and you want to warn people for damage, you want to know about the radius of maximum wind. So the radius of maximum wind, this is a function of time for all these ensemble members, the variability is not too bad for the coarse grain radius of maximum wind vortex. But during the rapid intensification process, watch out, because what you're going to see, you're going to see these individual hot towers, like in a Wilma. You're going to see one of these hot towers just taking off. And that's intrinsically unpredictable. Okay. So radius of gale force winds looks much more predictable among the ensemble members. Radius of gale force winds increases with time. Okay, that's actually quite interesting. I understand why that is. The vortex is growing in size, okay, despite this local upscale cascade that's taking place in the center. It's also growing in size on a larger scale. Okay, and we've done some sensitivity experiments, and I want to finish with one sensitivity experiment. We include evaporation, downdrafts, still get intensification, and let me just explain these experiments here. I'm going to stop. The experiments here summarize the control experiment and the experiment where you take the fluxes at the lower ocean surface, at the ocean surface, and you limit them by their wind speed. So you say if the winds exceed 10 meters per second, or they exceed 5 meters per second, I'm not going to allow any more watts per square meter than I can get at 10 meters per second. So wishy, if you think tropical cyclones intensify primarily by wishy, wind-induced surface heat exchange, wishy is essentially dependent on the evaporative feedback that couples with the increased wind speed. If you don't have increased wind speed, then according to wishy theory, you will not intensify a vortex. In this model, three dimensions, and also in the axisymmetric model, that appears not to be the case. The vortex with capped winds continues to intensify. If you have no winds, no fluxes whatsoever, the vortex consumes its cape locally and it runs out of gas. So the mean winds don't intensify at all. But when you cap the winds, vortex, you don't allow the fluxes of latent and sensible heat to increase with wind speed beyond what they would be at, say, 5 meters per second, 10 meters per second.
And momentum or not?
No, you don't touch momentum.
So momentum is not capped.
Yep, we don't cap momentum, but we cap heat. Now, if you run this three-dimensional or you run this axisymmetrically, you get the same effect. In the axisymmetric model, the vortex intensifies very slowly. You gotta wait a long time, but it does intensify. So wishy doesn't appear to be crucial for intensification. Something else is going on involving the convection itself and the persistent amount of latent energy that a small background flux is able to provide. We just provide a little bit from the underlying ocean, and that's enough to get the vortex to develop a hurricane. Okay? We've seen this in two models, two independent models. Okay, so I'm going to stop. What I've shown is I've tried to motivate the big problem, highlighted a few examples of how coherent structures and vortex dynamics play a role. And hopefully we'll learn a lot more about that this week. Thank you.